It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, a Friday News Buzz edition. And later in our program, the controversy over the amount of ethanol in our tanks, a harvest update from Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Bill Northey, and in the second part of our program, we'll listen to more of your memories of this day 50 years ago when our 35th president was killed. Also, presidential historian Tom Schwartz will be along to give us his thoughts on that. Also, about the 150th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address, which is this week. But first, 15 disaster workers from the American Red Cross were deployed from Iowa to Illinois earlier this week. They're aiding in the recovery after Illinois and northern Indiana were hit by those tornadoes, if you remember, last Sunday. 16 tornadoes, at least 8 people died in those storms. 2 Iowa volunteers are helping out in Illinois, Ann and Kenneth Opatz of Lisbon, Iowa. Currently, the Opatzes are in Gifford, Illinois, a town of about 1,000 people. It was hit with an EF3 tornado, winds of up to 140 miles per hour. And as volunteers, the Opatzes are distributing food, beverages in a Red Cross emergency response vehicle. Ann Opatz joins us now by phone from the County Health Care and Rehab. It's a nursing home which is serving as the Red Cross's command center for Gifford. So, Ann, tell me what you're up to today.
Well, we just got done doing our morning run. We've sectioned the town into three different areas, and we take our emergency response vehicles out to those three areas. We just got done doing our section, so we've been out meeting and greeting people and providing them with hot coffee, hot cocoa, muffins, donuts, fruit, and those kinds of things. People aren't really looking for anything cold to drink today. It's quite chilly here, but it has stopped raining.
Mm-hmm. What are the comments you're hearing from the people as you hand out these items?
Oh, the people here are very, very grateful for any kind of assistance that is coming their way. We not only are serving the residents of Gifford, but we're also serving their many friends and neighbors who are coming in from near and far. We actually saw some license plates today in a driveway from Mississippi. And in the last couple of days, the town has been inundated with linemen who have come in from Tennessee and Kentucky and Michigan and of course, a lot of linemen from the state of Illinois. They're trying desperately to get the power restored to the people here. And they've made great strides. And it's really nice to see that there's traffic in town today other than these big boom trucks that the linemen are driving. When we went out last night, we noticed that much of the electricity had been restored to the central area of the town. And now individual home hookup will take place in the next couple of days. So it's looking a little bit better.
And
the town looks pretty desolate when there aren't any lights on.
Yes, I imagine so. Ann, what day did you and your husband show up?
Let's see. Ken and I were deployed out of Cedar Rapids on Monday morning. We stopped in Peoria to get our assignment, and then we headed over here to Gifford early in the morning on Tuesday of this week.
Give us a sense, if you could, of the destruction you saw there in Gifford when you arrived.
Well, many of the homes and buildings are destroyed or they're severely damaged. We're seeing personal belongings that are destroyed, laying about in front yards and backyards. Farm fields are full of debris. When we first got here on Tuesday, lots and lots of trees and power lines down in the streets. People looking for missing pets. At that time, it was a town without electricity, and it was a town without water. But it's looking a lot better today. So, you know, every day makes a difference.
Ann Opatz, a volunteer, along with her husband, Ken, from Lisbon, Iowa, helping out in the areas struck by tornadoes last weekend in Illinois, a volunteer for the American Red Cross in Gifford, Illinois. Ann Opatz, thank you for updating us, and you're making us proud with the great work over there in our neighboring state.
You're welcome. We're happy to represent the state of Iowa in this.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we've all gotten used to filling up our cars and trucks with gas containing ethanol, an additive made from corn. And the increasing use of this renewable biofuel across the nation has been a huge boon to farmers here in the Midwest. But now the Environmental Protection Agency is considering a reduction in the required amount of ethanol for the U.S.'s gasoline supply, and that's proving a bit controversial. Amy Mayer is with us, Harvest Public Media's reporter at Iowa Public Radio. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Ben.
So tell us, what has been the course up to now before we talk about the proposed change?
There's a law called the Renewable Fuel Standard, and it was first created in 2005, and it was updated in 2007. And the way one of my colleagues put it, it's kind of a blueprint for how much renewable fuel from various sources will be on the market over time. And it maps out up to, I think, 2022 was its longest projection in 2007.
I remember this was sort of from the George W. Bush era that we were, and also into Obama, that projected that we will be ever increasing the amount of biofuels in our fuel supply, right?
Exactly. It was a George W. Bush era law that the Obama administration really got behind, and it had a lot of supporters, and it has had a lot of supporters. But there have been issues with various aspects of it in terms of meeting the goals and what the widespread implications are for the different types of renewable fuels.
Okay, so now there's a possibility of the reduction in the required amount, so the set course, changing the set course. What's causing that?
There's a couple of factors that are influencing that. One of the primary ones is that it's something called the blend wall. Right now, as you mentioned, we have 10% ethanol in most of the gasoline sold in this country. There are some gas stations, especially here in the Midwest, that sell E15, which is 15% ethanol. But there's a lot of controversy around various types of engines and whether E15 is safe for those engines. So E15 hasn't really taken off. And that means if more ethanol is produced, there's not really a place in the market for it.
Do we know definitively from what does science tell us about whether engines are harmed by E15 compared to E10?
This is one of those areas where if you get enough scientists to do studies, you're probably going to get more different answers to your questions rather than a definitive one. I say that because the engine makers, who obviously have a lot of experience testing engines, have different answers from what the proponents of ethanol have. But the general concern is that engines older than 2001, car engines, may not perform as well with E15. And smaller engines, such as those in motorcycles, boats, lawnmowers, other farm equipment that run on gasoline, not diesel, also may not perform as well with E15. Mm-hmm. And one other thing that I think is worth noting, although I haven't seen it a lot in the discussions, is that ethanol actually burns a little faster. So if you have a higher percentage of ethanol, you get fewer miles per gallon.
You get a little less power in your tank.
Exactly.
Okay. I understand a couple trends in this change, too, that actually are good ones. We Americans are driving less. We're conserving energy. Also, our vehicles are becoming more efficient.
Those things are both true. And I think on the more efficient, that is probably something that prognosticators considered when they wrote the law. But they certainly thought that we would continue to use an increasing amount of gasoline rather than have our consumption diminish.
Okay. So if we picture this in a pie chart form, we're driving less. We're consuming less fuel also because our cars, our vehicles are more efficient. And on the current course, the ethanol gets to have what is an increasing part of the pie because the pie is shrinking, and big oil doesn't like this?
That's definitely part of it. Perhaps the biggest thing that big oil doesn't like is that it becomes slightly less big oil. But it is also that it gets kind of complicated with that thing called blending that I mentioned, but it has to do with who's obligated to include the ethanol and then how they're going to sell that product. And so, yes, big oil doesn't like the idea that there is less market share for petroleum products, but it also bears the burden of getting that ethanol into the marketplace. I mean, it's shared among various legs in the supply chain for gasoline, but that's also part of it. There's a relationship there between big oil and the ethanol producers.
Mm-hmm. So where are we right now in the consideration, this proposal to reduce the amount of required ethanol in gas?
The EPA released its recommendations last week. There will be a 2-month comment period when anybody with an interest can submit their formal comments to the federal government. During this period, I think we're also going to see from a lot of different sectors a very vocal, very public debate about this. I don't know if what we'll see publicly will be two-sided or if what we're primarily going to see will be the people who support ethanol trying to make sure that this proposal doesn't become the actual mandate, but we'll just have to see how that plays out.
Tell us about the two sides. The pro-ethanol side obviously includes agriculture, farmers, and the like, and their backers, right?
Right. In particular, Corn Belt farmers, of course. I mean, here in Iowa, later today, there's actually an event sponsored by Terry Branstad, Chuck Grassley, Steve King, notable business people in the ethanol industry, some corn farmers, all of them trying to rally support for their cause to what they call defending the RFS, the Renewable Fuel Standard. And there are some interesting comrades in that struggle. If you look nationally at what's happening, for example, there's a left-leaning veterans organization called VoteVets.org, and they are very committed to ethanol. For them, the important aspect is that more homegrown fuels reduce our dependence on imported oil.
Mm-hmm. And provide jobs to Midwest farmers and those who supply them.
Absolutely. Provide jobs to returning veterans, and also help support rural economies. And that's true for the politicians and the farmers who are supporting ethanol. If you look back at the origins of the RFS, definitely reducing our dependence on foreign oil was a huge aspect of that. But when I think about these different groups coming together right now, you know, it's this one particular veterans organization very committed because of the tie with foreign oil, as opposed to, you know, Corn Belt politicians who are very concerned about production agriculture and a destination for corn. And one other aspect on the agriculture side is concerns that if there's less demand for ethanol, it will bring corn prices down, mm-hmm. and that obviously has an impact in our states.
Right, and corn prices have already dropped significantly in the last year or so, haven't they?
They have, yeah. They mm-hmm. came down, and they came down a little bit more last week at the time of this announcement, although I did see there seems to be a slight creeping up already.
What about the other side, the anti-ethanol people? We have big oil. Who else do we have in that group?
That's an interesting question. Definitely big oil, and I suppose probably some of the other business interests that are most closely aligned with big oil. One interesting constituency is the environmental groups, where there does seem to be somewhat of a divide. On the one hand, environmental groups are disappointed in this proposal because it seems to represent diminishing of a commitment to renewable fuels. On the other hand, some environmental groups have raised serious concerns about what the actual environmental impact of raising corn for ethanol is. There were predictions about how good the reduction in greenhouse gases would be if we used more ethanol and fewer fossil fuels. Those numbers, some environmentalists say, haven't played out the way they were expected to. So I think environmentalists are split.
Right, because when we have this huge demand for ethanol, we tend to have higher corn prices, and then we don't leave as much for conservation, do we?
Exactly. And not only have conservation acres, which are already managed, been converted to corn acres, but there's a certain amount of land in the Midwest that had always been native prairie that got turned over for corn production mm-hmm. during the past 5 to 7 years.
What about the constituency of Iowa meat producers, people who raise cattle?
Exactly. That's the other group that falls on, I don't know that they would say they're on the side of big oil, but they're a group that is frustrated by this outpouring of objection because livestock producers have paid higher prices for feed because they're competing with the ethanol industry for corn. So for livestock producers, if there's less corn going into ethanol, that should mean lower prices for feed corn. And that would be a good sign for the livestock producers, and it would potentially help mitigate against rising meat prices that have also been predicted.
What does this all mean for us people who aren't farmers, the normal Joes and Janes out there filling up our tanks? Anything in the immediate future?
I think for the immediate future, there isn't going to be any change. Gas prices fluctuate pretty widely, and the price of corn and the impact of ethanol on those fluctuations remains quite small. Mm-hmm. And there doesn't seem to be any real momentum for E15 or the other high ethanol gasoline is E85, for which you need a flex fuel vehicle. So I think in terms of the consumer purchasing gasoline, these changes don't seem like they're going to have a big impact.
We've also, at the same time, we've been hearing updates, stalled farm bill in Washington, whether that anything will happen before Thanksgiving or between Thanksgiving and Christmas. Does this have anything to do with the farm bill right now?
There are those who are making a connection. I mean, certainly both of these issues are really fundamental to agriculture, so you can see why there would be connections. The chairman of the House Agriculture Committee, Frank Lucas of Oklahoma, did say this week that he thinks this EPA proposal to reduce the ethanol mandate potentially has a negative impact on farmers and therefore underscores the need to have the kinds of safety nets and supports that are provided by the Farm Bill. Some might say that this is just one more way for people to come out and say we need a farm bill now. People have been saying this for months. So it's not a direct one-to-one relationship, but certainly if corn farmers fear they won't have as large of a market, they are going to be looking for more support from a farm bill.
Before we let you go, Amy Mayer, a look into your crystal ball as our Harvest public media reporter at Iowa Public Radio. Who's going to win this, big oil or big agriculture?
Way to put me on the spot, Ben. Thanks. My prediction is that the mandate will stay lowered as it was proposed, but that in the end, ethanol is going to win because ultimately, if we look longer term than just 2014, we're still going to have a huge demand for ethanol and other renewable fuels, especially cellulosic, which is using all that stuff that's left over after the grain harvest.
Very interesting. A controversial debate with a lot of factors feeding into it. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media's reporter at Iowa Public Radio. Thank you for taking the time to explain this to us.
Thank you, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a News Buzz edition of our program. We like to have quick conversations on Fridays to catch us up on recent news we didn't get to otherwise. Well, when last we spoke with my next guest, he was actually sitting in his combine harvesting crops on his farm in northwest Iowa. He joins us once again. Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Bill Northey, welcome back to our program.
Good to be with you, Ben.
On your farm, everything going well?
Yes, it did. It was good to be done, and most of the areas around the state are done. My yields were disappointing to compare to what I would have liked at the beginning of the year. I think about a low 160 to 165 bushel, 45 bushel soybeans, 165 bushel corn. Little less than some normal, but certainly better than what it could have been with the kind of year we just had.
Tell us how much of the corn and bean crop has yet to be harvested.
As of the beginning of this week, we still had 7% of the corn out in the field, which is several hundred thousand acres of corn and certainly probably $600-700 million worth of corn out there. Mm-hmm. But just the last 7% and just 1% of the soybeans. So just the last few soybeans probably across southern Iowa.
The wet weather this week, has that complicated lives of farmers?
Yeah, probably has slowed some down here. I saw some folks early in the week. You could tell that they knew some wet weather was coming. They were working into the night trying to get some harvest done. So it definitely has slowed some harvest, although we've had, for the most part, pretty good harvest weather.
When we talk about regions of Iowa, have there been any problem areas that you want to point to?
We probably show, normally we show a later harvest in southern Iowa. Of course, our weather is usually better there later, and so it's we can still harvest into December. Sometimes in northern Iowa, we can't harvest into December, and so we push harvest pretty fast in northern Iowa. So we haven't seen really weather problems in one place or another bother much more. Some of the things that have slowed down harvest is moisture levels in the crop itself, especially in the corn. So often when we harvest corn, we have to dry it a little bit mm-hmm. before it's ready to be able to go to a bin and stay in good condition. We've had to dry it more than normal in some places, and then it kind of caused it to be cool and wet here, so the drying didn't continue to happen. And so that slowed harvest as folks could harvest faster, but they needed to have a dryer that would keep up with it.
What can you tell us about how, at this point, and how this year's harvest compares with previous years?
Well, our beans are lower than some years, even lower than last year. Our corn is definitely better than last year, still a little bit less than what we consider average yields for now. We'd expect average yields to be 175, 180 bushels average yield for the state. We're going to end up closer to that 169, 170 bushels. For soybeans, we would consider normally low 50s, 51, 52 bushels. an acre average, I think we'll end up about 45 bushel average. So a little bit less, but considering a terrible planting season, and then many parts of the state dried out, most farmers are pretty happy with what they got, considering the conditions that the crop was grown in this year.
When we look to the coming months, preparing for winter and preparing for the next growing season, what's the outlook?
You know, I think optimistic. We're always optimistic. We always think next year is going to be a better year than this last year. We always have some things we'd like to try and do different. We've got some folks out there using cover crops and doing different tillage or fertilizer technologies, trying to be a little bit better at what they're doing. We do have lower prices than what we did a year ago at this time. And so as we look at the 2014 crop and the prices when we plant that crop, the expectation of what the harvest price would be, the expectations would be lower than what it was this year.
How does that change things?
It changes several things. So certainly it changes the extra dollars that you have to replace equipment or to build a machine shed or those kinds of things. It causes folks to say, you know, if there's not going to be much income from the crop itself, then I've got to watch my expenses even closer. I'm going to make sure that, you know, I don't buy the most expensive seed if I can get good seed for less dollars. And if I can save money on herbicides or fertilizers, I'm going to find a way to do that.
How do those lower prices affect conservation?
You know, we still see folks look at it in conservation, and we expect land prices probably to soften up. That often is makes it easier to take some land out of production when we need to. But it does take profits often to invest in conservation. So I think we'll still have enough profits to do that. I certainly think that most farmers felt like the higher prices we saw recently was going to continue forever, so they certainly didn't spend all that money. They saved some of it. They still have it. They've paid down some of their debts, so they're in good financial shape. So I think they're still going to do the things that are necessary to take care of that land, to do the right things out there, although it's going to be a little bit more of a squeeze with the lower prices than what it's been.
I wonder if, in closing, you can give us an update on progress on a farm bill in Washington.
Boy, you know, it's just been such a long haul. It really would have been nice to get this thing done a year ago or this summer. It does look like we have some momentum now. So it looks like there's a possibility that something could get done before the end of the year. Some pieces are starting to come together, although there's still some big pieces yet to do that.
Iowa's Secretary of Agriculture Bill Northey, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment on News Buzz after a short break, listen to more of your memories about this day 50 years ago when our president, John F. Kennedy, was killed. Also, presidential historian Tom Schwartz will be along to talk about that and the 150th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.